Last Tuesday, I've been mainly talking about the quantum spin Hall effect. And so this is the layout of the overall talk. I told you about the Mercator band structure, which is inverted and leads to the quantum spin Hall effect. And basically, the situation a year ago was that we had quantized conductance in nanostructures, which looked, and we had an even resistance, which we also wanted to see, which looks like the quantum spin Hall effect is indeed occurring in samples. Now, when you're a transport physicist and you talk about the quantum Hall effect, there's some more things you want to know. One thing is that you want to see non-local transport through the S-channels. And that's actually what I discussed last week. So we made these structures with all kinds of legs attached to them. I showed you we see a non-local signal, and the signal is actually quantized according to a calculation that you can do using the Landau-Kritikar model, just as you use for the quantum adiabatic normal quantum model. Now, there's one thing remaining in the identification of these quantum spin Hall S-channels, and that's their spin-full character. And so that's the topic I want to talk about today. Many people have asked me, why don't you measure the magnetization in these S-channels with a scanning script or something like that? Well, the answer is that it's very, very difficult. It's well, perhaps it's just as the detection limit off top of the range apparatus these days. But then the magnetic signal from the spins is smaller than the Lorentz field from the current. So it will be very difficult to really find out what's going on in the channel simply from a direct magnetic measurement. So the road we've chosen to go is what most transport physicists do. If you cannot measure a magnetic field, you turn it into a charge. Because charge you can measure very easily. And the way about it actually goes through the metallic spin Hall effect that David has been talking about a lot. But the one we have in our samples, this is because we have ballistic samples, this is not the extrinsic spin Hall effect, it's the intrinsic spin Hall. And so that's the story. And part of the story actually we talked about later on by Angelina. Oops. Interesting. When she put in bubbling on the experiments. But okay, so this is the part on the intrinsic spin Hall effect in metals, and metals here simply is mercury telluride with the Fermi level in the conduction or Fermi band. So these are all inverted structures I'll be talking about, simply because we also wanted to use the intrinsic spin Hall effect to measure the quantum spin Hall effect. So, well, these are all introductory slides, and actually there's some movies in here which I probably won't show because I still don't have pyro. You're not going to show the movies.
Huh? Which, I don't know, if I'm talking, so.
I'm not talking at all. Okay.
Maybe after you, if there's 20 minutes left. If
just to show the homework of kind of that I'm just showing a while. But, I mean, this, of course, is the paper by Hirsch that really got everybody going again into the spin Hall effect, and this is a creative masterpiece on actually what the spin Hall effect does to electrons if you look that for an experiment. But anyway, so this, I guess everybody agrees, this got the field going again. There have been spin Hall effects before in all kinds of deliberation on spin transport, but Hirschfeld is all focused again. Hirsch's paper is mainly about the extrinsic spin Hall effect. Well, this, I guess, also David mentioned, the accident has been all affected from spin dependent scattering and impurities within the metal. And there's two types of them, skew scattering and side jump scattering. And there have been observations, as we just heard very extensively. Most observations, or at least the first observations, were optical. So there was the work in Santa Barbara. There's a group at the College of Cambridge, and they both use optical techniques to show the spin hall effect. And that you use optical techniques is quite reasonable, because actually in optics you're way more sensitive to spin accumulation than ion transport. Meanwhile, there are a couple of groups worldwide who have seen this extrinsic spin hall effect due to impurity scattering, mainly in metallic structures, real metals, not semiconductors. And the effects that you observe are pretty small. So I fully agree with David that for any applications of the spin hall effect, I would say three more, but it's nice physics. The quantum spin hall effect, by the way, is way bigger. So perhaps if we can have high temperatures, we should try something similar, perhaps. Anyway, there's also another spin hall effect. This simply comes from the band structure. This is the intrinsic spin hall effect. And so this is Gairo's paper a couple of years ago. Well, for me, the intrinsic spin hall effect is all about conservation of angular momentum. And that's also actually the way we try to measure this effect. And the way we go about it actually was already in this first paper of 1999. We adopted this geometry to what we have dubbed an H-bar for obvious reasons. So these are structures where we pass the current through one leg of the mesa. And if it's a spillover coupled system, angular momentum conservation will force a spin current in a pure spin current in a perpendicular direction. So this is your basically your spin hall effect. But now when the spin current encounters a boundary, again you have a problem with conservation of angular momentum. As a result of that, you will have through what's called these days the inverse spin hall effect. The accumulation of spin here in the spin orbit metal will cause a fault distance jump across these sides. Perhaps it's better if I just use my pointer. So that this works, we already knew a while ago. This is a calculation of Evelina with Gairo. I think you were in Texas then, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And basically it shows that in a ballistic sample, even with some scattering, you should see this effect. And actually, already in those days, we tried to measure that. But the reason there were no experiments published was that the samples were really big. And as a result, we believe that we didn't see any appreciable effect at the time. And one reason is that actually you should not measure this in samples that are not ballistic, because you have vertex corrections. And the vertex corrections identically cancel the spin hall effect in these type of systems. I think I flashed this one also the other day. If you have a sample that's very lowly doped, you can actually scan with the gate voltage, scan the material through the NIP transition, and actually we saw this friendly local system in 2003, which actually turned out to be later on the spin hall. Perhaps I should mention that if you work with this type of structures, this is what you do is actually in your experiment you measure this voltage as a function of the of a gate which you apply over all of the system, and the idea is that you always have a finite voltage drop across these guys here because you put the current here. But that's a pretty minute fraction, actually, of the original bias that you apply. And the other thing is this will not depend on gate voltage. So if you see something that depends on gate voltage, you can be pretty sure it's the spin hall effect. So that's basically all I wanted to show you today. So I think we, not as far, we can go with these transitory experiments, at least to show that we have not only conductance conservation, we clearly have also the non-local signal due to the F-signals, and these last experiments are can only be interpreted by assuming that indeed the voltage signal and F-signals are strength tolerant. And I agree there's a lot to be done to get another magnitude estimate on the size of the circuit. Okay, so thank you.
Any questions to Lawrence?
Yes, yeah. Mr.
So what's going on? So I expect that there might be electronic reconstruction at the surface between the metal and the insulator.
Yes.
And so that the story is not so simple. How do you explain? So
well, what kind of this has to be modeled somehow. So basically, what you see, Xiaoyang, is he here?
Yeah.
Here. I mean, you told me that, you looked a bit at this, right? You told me that basically when a F-channel hits a metal, the state has to fill up and then scatter it on the top.
Yeah.
So that's basically what's going on.
And the EM model, you can calculate the rate, how much weight of this center is kind of on that.
But of course, what you can also say is that the resistance of a quantum channel towards the channel actually is a contact resistance. So you know that if you have an ideal situation, the resistance should be
always below range.
I mean, that you know already. But there's this spin thing which is in between, which I don't know really where the spin states are. I don't know.
So this maybe is a little bit better, but is there anything you can learn in these experiments in that kind of field? So,
the question is, I mean, the effect will go away.
Well, the power goes away.
I mean, perhaps you should try this, yes. I mean, well, from what you will get is that the voltage can hopefully go away in no time, but the perpendicular field is as we saw it.
Actually, from that point of view, it would be interesting in terms of the detecting of the spin hole effect through the channels, because if you have the gating, right, you will see the signal of the channel, of the spin hole effect affecting the channel edge being destroyed much faster, because you don't have the probing tool, it's gone by that effect.
Yes. Yeah, but at least for a simple Rashba model, when you put it in a perpendicular magnetic field, you just get scaling of alpha, where alpha is in orbit coupling strength Kf divided by Zeeman field. So you can estimate how it's supposed to be, at least from the simple.
So it doesn't do anything particularly interesting.
Yeah.
It basically goes away, yeah.
I already asked. Oh, okay. Is there any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Lawrence again. We had a last minute change of schedule. Maybe it would be better to keep sort of morning as experimental session.
Let me do the suggestion and then see what you think.
What you can see is to talk about the experiment purely, it's mostly an experimental talk.
Yeah, it's more experimental talk. So
is it okay to get the two talks in the afternoon, two theory talks? And we have
and this is actually half experiment, half talk.
So
a summary.
Very brief,
I think the idea is to get more people to.
People will be here today than tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. Well, because a lot of people are leaving now, right?
So we'll have Hyrule telling us about the experiment.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I sound so much in my question is telling that Lawrence said with all this topological stuff. When I ask questions, I sound more like an experimentalist than. But I'm a theorist that likes a lot of experiments. Many of my papers are with experiments, but I'm allowed to present this. So it's going to be, and we're coming back a little bit more to the extrinsic effect in a way, but it's a new effect.
that you've seen that in terms of the plan, how about that?
So thank you for having me here in the workshop, by the way. Yeah, it's been very useful time. The thing I'm going to talk about is this idea of this spin injection Hall effect, a new member of the family of spintronics effects that we've been seeing. And there's lots of different effects that have happened, but of course they all have their origin on the anomalous Hall effect, which is a very old, very long one, very basic, and it's still at the very heart, very fundamental one. We have not heard, but also Susan Zhang has very beautiful theories and ideas on quantum anomalous Hall effect, which I think would be very interesting in the future. And from there you start having different cousins. The spin Hall effect is the kissing cousin of the anomalous Hall effect in a way. It's slightly more complicated, of course, because here you have the problem of the spin not being a conserved quantity. But the basic phenomenology sharing a lot of the ideas. And from there, immediately follows the basic idea that's been presented to you of the spin inversion, inverse spin Hall effect. And all of these guys, of course, are related very closely because they all share basic physics of mechanisms generated, etc. So at the very heart of it, one thing that one can try to follow is that you still have some basic, not so much anymore, but there was a lot of debate that was generated, uninherited in the spin Hall effect that was present in the anomalous Hall effect for a long time. So then one thing that you can also ask yourself is, many of these motivations that we keep saying about the spin orbit coupling and things like that, you want to go towards a spin-based non-magnetic field effect transistor device. You have the very archetypical, type of data dust that has not really been performed for a long time for various reasons, mainly that, no longer the spin coherence in the rush by spin orbit coupled systems, the problem that has avoided happening this. But from this, we were motivated from our studies and utilizing this technology that we developed, that now I can explain as we Wunderlich developed, to observe the extrinsic spin Hall effect, in this two dimensional coplanar LEDs. Where you can actually now generate these spin channels, these two-dimensional channels with a two-dimensional pore gas and a two-dimensional electron gas in each side. And the basic idea when we were studying the basic studies of the last year and a half or 2 years of anomalous Hall effect from trying to merge the theoretical understanding is that we propose to utilize this type of device where you create this two-dimensional coplanar LED, and then you create these Hall probes and generate the spin injection, reverse bias, and see if you can understand the anomalous Hall signal generated. So experimentally, the device itself is actually technologically very interesting, and I hope that more people begin to use it. You buy these wafers that you can actually do with these two quantum wells. One of them is doped with N doped, the other one P doped. When both of them are together, the P doped wins. And therefore, it's actually a p-doped two-dimensional substrate with the n-doped depleted, and then you create you dry edge it, and then you wet edge a part of it. And once you remove the top, you create, of course, the two-dimensional electron gas on the other side, and you have the p-n junction in between. Then you can do the bias, creating a reverse bias by driving the holes on one side, the electrons on the other side, injecting through the light, polarized light, and that way you create spin polarized currents one way and the other, so in both directions. Okay. So therefore, trying to generate an anomalous Hall effect in two-dimensional electron gases. So basically, we studied the anomalous Hall effect in two dimensions. Not such a thing as a ferromagnetic two-dimensional Hall effect, but a ferromagnetic system, but that's the best way to create. So the basic idea also is that at this stage you have a choice of what excitation energy or wavelength to do. The nice thing about it is because you create these excitations from the trapped electrons, and then you can actually show that when the light, you can actually below the light is the start effect, just below the gap
it's slightly below the gap. If you actually just shine a bulk system across the gap, you don't get a fully polarized current, because you're exciting mostly from the negative half to this plus half, but you can also excite from the plus one half to the minus one half. Okay, but once you trap these systems due to the Stark effect, you actually only generate mostly at this stage from this one to that one, because these guys are from below. And that allows you to almost generate a fully polarized current. So the experiment, of course, was done. You can first generate, make sure that it's sort of not independent. So the time study is very long. It's essentially to stabilize things. You measure your voltage, and now you generate your light and try to measure the whole probe voltage. And with one polarization, you get one sign, and actually rather strong. This is is a rather strong signal. And in terms of whole angles, tends to be a favor of 10 to the minus 3, which is actually rather large. And then you put an unpolarized light, and you get zero, and you reverse the polarization, and then you get the opposite sign as well. So that was, of course, already.
So in the initial design, I'm still wondering about how, what did make them choose this spacing of the electrode?
Of the electrode?
Yeah.
The 1 micron?
Yeah.
Just that it was feasible.
Okay.
So there was a lot of luck involved in this thing. Okay. So Susan Tsang actually visited us. This is all great recent work. The results came available 3 months ago when I was in sabbatical in Prague. Susan Tsang came to visit us as well, and we had already been thinking about it for a couple of weeks, and many things generated rather fast from there. From that, we got all very excited, everybody, about the idea. One thing, of course, is that even though the thing is you're shining the light very precisely here, which is a bit difficult and creates some drift, so some of your power can be drifting a little bit, but it's not really related to the signal that you're seeing, because here you're actually seeing the resistance is rather constant. And you can see it from the point of view that both the current and the voltage that you measure also follow this drifting power from the fact that that it's not perfectly aligned through the time that you have it shining on it. But the thing that is actually rather interesting in this experiment, and actually that's the thing that really got me excited, is the following. You measure your system, you see your Hall effect, an almost Hall effect, which is nice. I'm going to show you why it makes sense also both theoretically as well. But then you measure in the other legs, because there's 3 legs that we have. Actually, we have 4 legs now, so that we also measure the value 0, which is not totally related. And you see that it's actually the opposite sign, slightly lower. Okay, so 4 times lower in the signal, but it's a slightly lower sign. So you go from a slightly negative to a large plus, and then you measure the other one to another minus. Okay, so you got it here. Okay, the 0th one actually is actually plus as well, and almost as large as this one. But this one we usually didn't put at the beginning because it's generated right at the edge. So there's also, it could be another spurious effect, so we were not comfortable showing it. But it's also there, so you actually have plus, minus, plus, minus. So it's suggesting, I'm not going to say that it's processing, because 3 points do not make a sign. But it certainly is very suggestive. Okay, that's all I can tell you. You have a magnitude and changes along the strike channel of the order of a micron or so. Okay, which actually should make you think that in a Rashba system, just purely Rashba spin of a coupled system, you would not expect any precession because the actual defacing is too strong, it's over damped. And you actually can show that you're never going to get any oscillation. You're going to get, from spinning it polarized up, it will go down, and then maybe just over, under, down, and poof. You're not going to go up, down, up, down. Okay? So you have to worry about that fact. But from the point of view of just phenomenology of this thing of being an anomalous Hall effect, it is very much the spin injection Hall effect. I call it spin injection Hall effect because it's not a ferromagnetic system. We're actually injecting the spins. But it's very much an almost Hall effect in the sense that it is linear in the polarization that you inject. This is actually a function of polarization in the first leg, for example. You can show that it's the same thing for the second leg, with opposite sign, of course. In the whole side, because you have the facing side, the spin coherence is 1 micron, so which is actually much smaller much longer than the spin appearance in the hold-up system with the song is recovering, you're going to expect to see a signal. And of course, you see a signal that is very tiny, almost within resolution, so I wouldn't call that a signal. If you shine it right on top of it, yes, you see a strong signal, but here it may not be exactly only the force that you're measuring. You may be also measuring the electrons as well, which are below this layer. So you know, we haven't analyzed this the key part as well, because it's not as interesting. But from the point of view of the temperature, you know, and things like that, achieving, we can only get to 270 Kelvin in the systems. And you actually see, you know, the oscillations as well, much more reduced, of course, by a factor of 10, I think. But you still are seeing it very distinctly in the system. Let me emphasize one thing. This is, to my knowledge, and we've been looking very carefully, the first non-destructive electric measurement of polarization along a semiconducting channel without any ferromagnetic elements. First, that I know. If you know of any, please let me know, because I want to know. But it is a big deal in that sense, you know, to actually have
Russian people,
you know, maybe some Russian guy, you know, somewhere in Siberia or something, and he got the low temperatures for free. But, I don't know. I was spending the whole week looking around. And in that sense, I think that's rather exciting. It's actually a new way of probing all these things in these techniques, I think, which I hope people begin to use. It is non-destructive. It's unlike the non-local with ferromagnetic contact. It's sort of non-destructive in your channel. You're measuring it one side, and it still remains far away. And it's not, it's electric. It doesn't have any requirements of, you know, from the point of view of devices and the fact that you can go to 270 Kelvin. I hope they get the guys excited in the meeting up in San Francisco. And also at the same time, we like it because this is actually a photovoltaic cell. If you actually just shine the light and don't put a bias, you also get a signal. So, you know,
so that's a diffusion current.
Yeah, of course. Because you have a non-nuclear system here, and then it diffuses away, and you can solve the diffusion equations that Andre put under. Andre, I'd like to thank him for very tremendously for that. So it's a lot of little things that
just like a solar cell.
Say again?
So in the actual solar cell, it's
a solar cell. Actually, I don't know. We don't call it solar cell because it's not the sun that is shining. So you know, it's not like you're going to take it outside and say, oh, look at my spin polarization, you know? But, a laser cell, I don't know.
how much power are you putting in?
Oh, that was in the first slide. I can't still remember. Sorry. I don't do anything. I have a I'm a theorist, as you know. But I'm very friendly experimental if you like me somehow. Kind of affable. Sorry. Let me go down.
Oh, really?
The power earlier. I think I passed it. Sorry. Should be here. Oh, okay. So sorry. Oh, it's in the paper. I'm sorry. I like. It's not heating it up, for example. But it's a very normal sapphire laser that you tend to use. And here you try to do it to fairly low powers. You don't want to smack the hell out of it. Okay, so let me just in the last, because I wanted to be quick, because we're all going to lunch and I promised to be 20 minutes only. From the point of view of theory, there's actually a good handle on what we understand of it, and actually it's rather beautiful physics that involves, you know, spin Hall effect. I know it's Hall effect because it's in a sense much easier. Okay, that's why, like, you know, once we got to the complicated spin Hall effect and all these debates, I said, well, you know what, I'm a very simple-minded person, so I'm going to go to much easier thing, but much more fundamental, I believe, which is the anomalous Hall effect, and there, I don't, you know, nobody's going to question me about spin or not. The fact that here these systems, these are gallium arsenide systems in the end of systems, we actually do know very well the actual effective Hamiltonian. It's really well understood. It's that. I can swear to you that that's that. Okay, and if, you know, there's not that many corrections at all. Not only that, these betas and alphas and lambda stars are also related to, you know, this is actually 5.3 angstrom squared that you heard before, that's known for a long time. These lambda stars and this alpha are not unrelated. You actually can compute it, these betas as well. Dresselhaus term. And the Dresselhaus term, it actually is proportional to the quantum confinement of the system. It's around minus 0.02 electron volts per angstrom for this effective mass that we have. And the alpha itself, for the given confinement that we have a range because we don't know exactly the precession of this. Unfortunately, in our system, we don't have a magnetic field with the Hausdorff oscillations to do these measurements. But you definitely can get between 0.01 and 0.03. This is an important fact. Notice that these guys are approximately opposite and equal to each other. Okay? Now, what the heck is special about that? That what is special about alpha approximate to minus beta, this is phenomenon carbon competing with each other, is the following, that if you actually just put alpha equal to beta minus beta on the other side, you actually get that the spin quantization axis along the 1-1-0 direction is a conserved quantity. Okay. That was understood by Schliemann and Loss a while ago, a couple of years ago. But then there's another important thing, that there's a long-lived precession spin wave, okay, that's perpendicular to this direction, that was demonstrated and shown by Bernwick and Andrea and Schusenzang. And it has to do very closely because of the fact that at alpha equal to minus beta or plus beta, the plus beta, of course, it would mean that instead of the 1-1 direction, it would be the 1-1 bar. Or direction, okay? That we have this very nasty effect of the Fermi surface, unlike in the rush bar where you have the spin up or the plus being outside and the minus being inside, it's not a nesting effect. In this case, you actually have a complete splitting of the nesting. And you can see that in this, you know, creating this magnetic excitation with this particular wave vector Q, this magnetic excitation, if you just commute it with your Hamiltonian, because it's a difference in energies between the up at Q minus down at Q, and because of the nesting effect, this is equal to zero. Okay, and therefore it's a conserved quantity and it gives you an SU symmetry. From this you can actually, you know, this is actually this picture that we're from, this is Schusenzang's slide. Uh-huh. This is his slide, it's not mine. Showing you why this is happening. Essentially, they both, you know, typically in the Rashba system, you start diffusing and drifting, and you start processing at different rates in different directions. So, things get screwed up very fast in terms of the spin curve and the spin. In this case, things going in a different direction, you can see that even though this is going faster and processing faster in this direction, in projecting along the direction of the spin helix, you actually have the same. So that's the basic physics of why this is happening. This is actually the spin helix that has been observed beautifully by the team of Ornstein with some samples provided by the Gashon. Well, you can see in this case their alpha was approximately the beta, so there in this case the spin helix is along the 1-1-0 direction. Okay. Along the 1-1 bar direction is a much lower spin coherence length, and you can show it very nicely. I think we have some new results coming up at some point showing much more basic things. But it's a beautiful experiment. It's a PRL. I like putting it in nature myself. But you can see it here, and you can also see very nicely that it corresponds to the corresponding wave vector of the nesting wave vector in these systems. Okay. So you can actually write down the charge, because this is a diffusive system, it's a nice well-controlled system, you can write down the spin charge drift diffusion equations. These were done by from taking it from Rupert's results and the sensor results, generalized to the both having alpha and beta, it's actually rather complicated calculation. And there, from this, you can actually just simply look for the steady-state solution along this 1-1 bar all direction. Okay, I forgot to mention. Our whole bars are along the 1-1-1 minus 1-0 direction. And, you know, I would like to say that it was intended. It was just luck, but it's also because of the typically those directions tend to be much easier for previous words, all the reasons to make them along that direction. I don't know if you would have been equivalent to do that along the one or direction in the system, which would have been bad. Anyway, we're rapidly making more samples as we speak. But you just simply solve these equations. They're very, you know, they look complicated, but they're not really. It's just put all these numbers in and solve for the steady state solution to see what type of steady state solution it has. You just have a transcendental equation, very simple to solve. It's just a little bit of algebra, nothing else. That's something that I can do. And you get, that is a function of, because here, you know, we don't know our alpha and beta exactly what we want, right? But you can make sure that, you know, we know it's approximately, you know, within a few percent from each other. And you can show that between the ratio of alpha and beta, the magnitude between 1.5 and 0.5, you actually have quite still perception effects going on from this skin killer state. So that's one aspect of the calculation in terms of showing you the oscillations. Now we also want to understand the magnitude of the signal. And that's another part that we can understand pretty well, because that's the thing that we've been studying the last couple of years, that I've been studying, focusing more on the anomalous Hall effect, going back from the spin Hall effect to the anomalous Hall effect, where we understand where all these terms are coming from. This is the intrinsic contribution, extrinsic contribution, or you can, this intrinsic, we can call it the scattering independent contribution rather than intrinsic, because the side jump, of course, has the same type of order of magnitude contribution. So you know that's more of a nomenclature naming per se. But one thing that we do know is that these dependencies that tells you that the anomalous Hall effect goes as rho squared or rho for metallic systems. Okay, non-metallic systems is not that's not the case. You do know that in strong spin orbit coupled systems you go as rho squared, indicating that this intrinsic is more than strong. And in the other ones, in the weak spin orbit coupled systems tend to be in the more diffuse orbit regime tend to be linear rho. Due to the skew scattering. This is actually something that we understand pretty well because you can actually make your calculations for both. You're going to have contributions from the spin orbit coupling of this part interacting with the disorder, normal disorder, this would be a disorder term here, but you also have the spin orbit coupling of the disorder contribution, which you cannot ignore, contributing from the from the normal non-spinary coupled part of the block electrons, and because the both of, you know, this is both of them are small terms, you don't have to worry about the one multiplying interacting with the other. You can actually do the calculations rather straightforwardly. The side jump itself, you do the calculation of this one from the side jump, you can show that it's 5 × 10⁻⁴, in order of magnitude lower than the expectation itself. And this one, the calculation you can do of the skew scattering, and you get an order of magnitude that is a lower estimate of 1 × 10⁻³. Lower estimate because here we have a parameter, which is Vnav, the strength of the scattering, which you can actually write in terms of the number of the scatterers itself. And here we put as the maximum number of scatterers as the density of carriers in the dark. So in that sense, it is a lower magnitude of the spec as a function. And it's also known to be linear in polarization, which is nice. There's other parameters here that we have that we tend to continue exploring to see how it depends. And actually, the thing that David left already that he mentioned on the nitrous to actually do, that you can do, mu and n being independent, that could be a valid expression, I think, to test this idea. Yeah. The intrinsic contribution, by the way, we have calculated it on its order of magnitude lower than even this for this regime. So that's why we ignore it. And then just putting it together, it just gives you the signals of the whole angle of around 10⁻³. Of course, in our experiment, we're probably in one side of this going up and down. But again, it's giving you the correct 0.5, you know, 1 micron, so the type of oscillation, so the order of magnitude, and certainly the data itself, the fact that you have 10⁻³, which is actually a very, very large whole angle, you know, much stronger than any. But most of the original metallic systems that have been observed for the inverse spin Hall effect, which is rather nice too. I just wanted to present to you that, you know, we have a new family member. All of them are related. I mean, you know, we call it spin injection Hall effect just to differentiate from the fact that there's no magnetic element in here, and also that you have, you know, essentially optically polarized, spin polarized current, given it's just current, so that's kind of I will break it up, but they're all very much related. The physics are matching pretty well. And hopefully this will become a new tool. There's advantages to this in the fact that this is a non-destructive electric probing of a spin propagation without magnetic elements. The next key thing would be, of course, which we've been trying and trying, but is that these are not easy to build, to gate them, of course. If you gate these suckers, you know, you get FET, spin FET. And this is as good as we've shown that you can get it, of course, because the alpha and the beta, the ratio, you can change with the gating. So you finally are in a regime where you can have a spin FET that works. I don't know if you can use it or if it would be better than any CMOS, okay? But damn it, it works, and it actually works at almost room temperature.
Would you need to keep alpha and beta changing the same way so that...
Well, but alpha and beta don't change the same way from a gate, right? Because the beta itself is more difficult to find, and it changes by not that much. You can change the ratio by 50%.
The beta is fixed, you change alpha.
Yeah,
so
if you just change alpha, then you do not have the spin kinetics.
That's the point. That you're going to be on and off. You know, you want a spin FET, right? On, off, signal, no signal. That's
really
that's
what was intended in spin FET.
I'm sorry?
That's not really what was intended in spin FET.
No, of course, we know, but okay, that's as close as we get. Okay, I'm sorry. Why else do you want? But from my point of view, actually, I hope to get to a regime where, you know, we have struggled a long time now for a couple of years of establishing this the strong connection of the anomalous Hall effect in different regimes, semi-classical, Kubo, and Kalnitz, putting it all together in a very cohesive way. You know, it's one of those painful things that you actually have to go through everybody's papers and make sure what they do, and if they make a mistake, you have to call them up and say, you know, I'd like to talk to you about this, and how about if we get together and write a big paper together and just fix it together? And it tends to be very constructive that way. So most of these guys have been writing papers now together. It's very nice. But at the same time, of course, this is an extrinsic regime that they're interested in. The key thing is to try to make these systems where there are more higher mobilities, and we begin to see more intrinsic effects, hopefully. Right? Because we have the strict, you know, precise predictions of how things depend on mobilities. So sorry I went 5 or 10 minutes ahead of my time. I just wanted to present to you that new idea, a new combination of now anomalous Hall effect, beautiful spin helix effects that have been observed from these guys, and many other new avenues that we can see. So thank you very much.
Any questions?
How general is it to have alpha equal to minus beta in this very much less simple? Is this
in this way, first, they tend to be not that far apart because the beta is of that order of magnitude and the alpha depends on the confinement. But those confinement electric fields that you have of the order, they're typical. So it's actually rather general, I would say. Of course, you know, you can have, of course, for the symmetric wells, you know, zero. So,
yeah.
But for the normal ones, we just stoke it generally. It's a fairly commercial wafer that they buy, and that seems to, you know, with actually the stoked P doping one side and doping one other side, and those electric fields generated from that separation is of that order.
Okay.
So besides gating, you can also tune out by asymmetry of the doping.
Yeah. And that, of course, is fixed in this case. So
yeah.
So I guess.
And of course, the basic idea what we're going to do next with Susan Stark collaborating with them is to, you know, in this spin helix, you put a magnetic field along this other helix, direct, you know, perpendicular to the helix direction, and you can extend or contract the period as well. You know, an AC as a function of P fields is obvious. But then the one thing, you know, also as well, what happens when you go off angle. Many things to study, I think, that are going to be interesting. And these ones, because they're fairly benign, much simpler system. It's not as sexy as the topological things, but it allows you, from the point of view of devices, of the industry giving us money, this one you can actually do modeling even at finite temperatures, unlike everybody here that has zero temperature in mind.
So what about Q?
Well, in that case, that one is much smaller in this system.
Yeah, I would think
that's like two orders of magnitude smaller. So that one we put in there, that should not play a role at all. And you can actually estimate it. So that we estimate it to be an orders of magnitude smaller. So that was very nice from the systems. It will not be once you get to the low mobilities.
Well, perhaps people who are more interested in detail can continue discussions. And we'll meet again at 2 p.m. To hear from Ibar and Evalina.
And the summary.
And the summary for the project, right?
Great. Thank you.